Thank you all for coming, and thank you, Tamal, for inviting me. I appreciate that very much. I want to visit a little bit about some challenges in evapotranspiration. Pretty simple outline background why I'm interested in doing this, some of the barriers I think we face in doing it, a bit about simulation and measurements, since I spent half of my career doing each of them, and some parting thoughts. Well, recently I've gotten interested in regenerative agriculture. And from my conversations here, it's pretty clear that regenerative agriculture is not, it's not a term that's in common use among our community here. So I thought, well, maybe I should say a little bit about what it is. It's really a response of practitioners to modern agriculture. And it's meant really to deal with natural processes, not to dominate them, right? And it really focuses on organic matters, and it's complex enough that really it's probably never going to work in the modern era without science, without science being involved in this movement on a daily basis. And it focuses on a lot of variables that we know for a long time have been good for soil health. In particular, converting as much of the sunlight as we can into carbon. That this is really the crux of the whole regenerative movement. And it's based more on biology and knowledge than it is on chemistry and capital. So it's a somewhat different approach. And it's meant to do a lot of good things. But everything is, right? So this is words, so many words. And putting the substance into these words really involves doing it or else being convincing with the science that you do. So I've done quite a bit of reading because there's nowhere you can go to find a center of regenerative agriculture. This is a diverse, disconnected, disjoint community, and I've been reading a number of books, and this one on the right, this holistic management, is probably the Bible of the movement. It's the oldest book, and it's really well worth reading because it gives you the underpinnings of why this is an important thing to do and why it will succeed ultimately. But at the same time I've been doing this work on regenerative agriculture, I've been studying the history and philosophy of science. A dangerous thing for a scientist to do. Bench scientists divorced ourselves from the historians and the philosophers a long time ago, mid-1900s. Because they deal with how science really works, and the data on what we do disagrees a great deal with our image of what we think we do. And we don't like that, and so we don't deal with it. I mean, how many of you in here have had a course in the history or philosophy of science as a grad student? One, two, three. Okay, so there's that gives you some feeling for how popular they are amongst us. For example, the human mind doesn't solve problems, it just elaborates on the questions. And these sorts of things irritate us, right? So I thought, well, maybe I really need to get some feeling for this before I invest too much into it. Does it really make sense? Can I make it jibe with the science that I know? So I thought, well, I'll create a simple model, very simple, Excel with no macros. You know it's got to be simple if you're going to do it with Excel with no macros. At the same time, I got invited to get involved with the measurements program in regenerative agriculture by some people who really want to help farmers make the transition from chemical agriculture to biological agriculture. And these measurement systems are, it's actually pretty elegant. State-of-the-art measurement system. 15, 20 different variables on a portable system. You move it out of the field when the animals graze the pasture, and you move it back in when they're done, and you move it out when you harvest, and various things. So it's quite a challenge to build this thing, and this is a prototype right here. We'll come back to that a little later. So I think my motivation for getting involved in this is that I think we need two changes in our agricultural research community. One is that we need to spend more time on what our values are and pursue that, rather than dealing with the economic survival issue. Now, I know, coming from somebody who's retired, those are big words because I don't have to do this anymore. I don't have to chase the money to survive. But the last 10 years of my career, I quit doing that, and in spite of that, money was actually never the limiting factor. So I think we can be value motivated and succeed. But the other thing we need to do is we need to change the paradigm for how science interacts with the farming community. I really believe we got to treat farmers as equals and work with them on their farms, and that this is the only way in which the science that we do is really going to get implemented on the ground and make a difference. I mean, there's virtually no involvement of this community in this regenerative movement, and it's potentially a very important future transition we're going to have to make if we want to sustain our food production and our farming systems. The diversity requirements of this approach are incredible, and probably it will never succeed in the modern era without science. We have some barriers, though, and the disciplinary barriers are a big part of the barriers that stop us from this. I mean, you look at the disciplines that are involved in going from rainfall to stream flow, there are some pretty big barriers between them. One of them is scale. The scale of these disciplines go from meters to kilometers. Well, disciplines that deal with different spatial scales use different methods for solving their problems. They have a different context for their existence, for how they think, which means that the barriers between these disciplines can easily become neglected interfaces. And the soil surface is one of those neglected interfaces between meteorology and hydrology and soil science or environmental biophysics. And we don't really have a discipline that deals with the soil surface. It's a boundary condition for these bounding disciplines, which means that the place you know the least about it. And doing this simulation becomes pretty clear it's also the place that controls not only the local partitioning of water, but also the watershed scale partitioning of water. So if we look at the water flow in this system, we can see that runoff and infiltration, stream flow are in hydrology, and infiltration and runoff are in soil science. And you notice I put the order of those words differently because for the most part, infiltration is an afterthought in hydrology, and runoff is an afterthought in soil physics. Soil physics, we deal with drainage, but of course, in hydrogeology, they call it recharge, not drainage. Right? And that's a context issue again, because it's leaving the soil science medium, so it's obviously drainage. It's entering the hydrogeology medium, which means it's obviously recharging things. It's all perspective, and we have very different perspective in our different disciplines. I mean, hydrologists are mostly engineers. They work from meter scales to watersheds. So physicists work from the meter scale down to pores. They have a really different perspective on things, and it means that the soil surface is not only a disciplinary boundary, it's a real physical boundary, too. And so there's really a paucity of understanding associated with it. Hydrologists really love runoff, and soil scientists really love infiltration. And the two formulations that they make at their boundaries are totally incompatible. Right? They won't go together at all. So if you want to work across this boundary, you start all over again. I mean, and this is sort of an issue because it's a problem when you're trying to deal with the whole system which the farmer has to deal with. So there's a couple of variables about the soil surface. One of them is surface sealing. And we know quite a bit about surface sealing, but you won't find it in most models. Macropore dynamics, we know quite a bit. We study a lot of it about this in soil physics. But you won't find either of these things in any of these integrated models to any credible extent, at least from what I've seen so far. So this is a major issue. I mean, hydraulic conductivity is a big deal when you're dealing with water and soil. It's a very important variable. It's one that the practitioners in regenerative agriculture don't understand at all. I mean, they think how fast the first ancient water goes in the soil is the same as hydraulic conductivity. But it's not. Vastly different, right? But we can predict this hydraulic conductivity, but we also know that it has a log normal distribution over any soil landscape. There isn't one value for a field. There's a whole range of values. And if you don't take the range of values into account, it's hard to actually get reasonable runoff characteristics. Right? So just thought I should really do a little with this. I took some measurements of this years ago on this particular field, mapped the clay and sand distributions, used the pedotransfer functions to get a hydraulic conductivity map. It's about a 10-acre field. And from that, produced a log normal distribution. The heavy dark line here is the measurements. The lighter lines are the fits from the pedotransfer functions using various depths of the textural maps, depending on how deep you think the infiltration matters. So this gave me some insight into the fact that we have some ability to predict this log normal distribution, but dealing with it in the modeling realm is a pretty big challenge. So I thought, well, maybe I should look a little bit with this simple model, since I've worked with these things in detail for years, on the log normal distribution of hydraulic conductivity, the influence of surface sealing, and the importance of macropore development. So those are three important parameters at the soil surface. Soil surface can dominate all three of these issues. So I thought, well, I'll do a simulation, picked a set of data from 2013 that looked interesting to me, and this is what the mean air temperature and the solar radiation looked like for that particular season. Pretty typical, a leaf area index curve, precipitation dependence on time, year, on day during the year 2013. And a sample of runoff when there was pretty good macropore development, because this is a no-till field, and so it's got pretty good macropore development in it. And so I thought, well, I'll check this log normal thing first. And this is one event in that year. It's this big spike you see here, about 5 inches of rain in a couple, 2-3 hours. And so the upper curve, the blue curve, is the rainfall distribution during that event. This is a couple hours of rain during that time. The yellow line under it is if the surface is sealed. If you've got bare soil and the surface is sealed, most of that water is going to run off. The red curve further down is if you don't have surface sealing and you've got good macropore development, which this field has, and you've protected the surface enough, then that's the runoff you would see in that red curve. The blue curve there is if you use a log normal distribution for this field that we had measured, instead of the single dominant silt loam hydraulic conductivity, which is what the red curve is. Right? So you see a little difference and you think, well, that doesn't look like it makes a lot of difference, but it's 30% in the runoff from 10% if you assume a single texture, the dominant texture type, and 13% if you use the log normally distributed. Well, that's kind of, if you got macropores, surface sealing isn't an issue anyway, if you can maintain the macropores. If, on the other hand, you had poor macropore development and you protected the surface so you did not get surface sealing, you still would run off 50%. 52% of that rain would still likely run off, at least in this simulation. And that curve, yellow curve you see on the top there, is 78% runoff if you surface seal it. So what you really learn from this is that the surface sealing is a big deal, so are macropores if they're open. And so the log normal thing, yeah, you can do or not do. It's painful to do it, so we don't do it usually. But what does it look like for the whole season? here you have the whole season where the rain is in the first grouping, infiltration, runoff, ET, drainage, and soil storage. And the three bars refer to good macropore development in blue, poor macropore development in red, and surface sealing in gray. You can see ET doesn't depend really very much on that condition in this soil because it stores a lot of water, and during the whole season you have a lot of slow rains that infiltrate through the surface seal anyway. And so this soil stores enough moisture that ET isn't really a very critical thing. But some of the other issues are drainage and infiltration increase with macropore development pretty strongly. Particularly drainage is changed by a ratio, by a percentage, quite a bit. On the other hand, runoff decreases. I mean, if the infiltration increases, the runoff decreases. You only got so much water. So this is the essence of regenerative agriculture. This very important part of regenerative agriculture is to shift the distribution of the rainfall in the system. So how do they do that? All of those things I was describing to you before. Right? Basically, increasing the carbon in the soil to get the biology to increase the macropore development. Because the macropore development comes from biology. There's no, you go to the lab and try to reproduce macropores and you can't do it. You just can't do it. It takes the biology to do that. And it takes trapping a whole lot more sunlight to give the biology the resources to generate that organic matter that gets reorganized into the soil system as macropores. So we know now that clearly these characteristics of the soil surface can have a profound impact, right? Profound impact. These are things that we know about and we understand, but we just don't deal with them very well. So here's a cartoon of a watershed, small watershed, but of a watershed. And ultimately in watersheds, a really important component is the stream flow. But those of us in soil science, we don't care about stream flow. Stream flow doesn't matter to us. But it's really why we do what we do. Because what is done on the land area that feeds that stream is what determines what comes out of that stream. And so we need to be caring about that a great deal. Stream flow is a critical thing. But if you look at the stream flow, you realize that it's a function of the change in the groundwater storage and the groundwater flow to the stream and the runoff. They're different components, they're different time scales, different spatial scales, but those two things add up. The runoff is a more local scale phenomena, whereas the groundwater flow is a watershed phenomena. That runoff is a function of precipitation and infiltration. One of those is watershed, one of those is local. The groundwater flow is a function of drainage, which is local, but it's also a function of the change in the watershed storage, which is more of a watershed scale. So what you find here is that you've got this range of different scales and you're trying to get the basic laws of conservation to work when you have variability on very different space and time scales. That's not a trivial enterprise to get all of that to work out. That's a very big challenge when the whole system is coupled. And we have to really face that issue, and because the local soil surface sealing and macropore development can have a profound impact on what happens to that stream. Now we know we can increase that runoff, that drainage factor locally. We can increase it by a factor of two or more in a decade. So we know we can do this with this regenerative farming because there's example after example out there with farmers who have persisted for 20 years doing this and making it happen. They need more help in the science, but they've done an amazing job with their intuition. If we can do that, we know that we're probably going to increase the drainage toward the end of winter and spring, which is when most of our drainage occurs. This is example of 8 years of drainage in a silt loam soil in Wisconsin. So we know that we can do this. What happens if we do? Well, this is a larger watershed, and if we start out at a drainage of a half a millimeter a day, which is 180 millimeters a year, we start out here at like 36 meters in this particular watershed. We end up with a time constant of 5 to 7 years. We can increase that by 6 or 7, 8 meters in one time constant, or about 5 to 7 years. So we can change this stream flow stuff if we can get enough people on the watershed to use methods that will favor the development of macropore and the trapping of the carbon. So this is a practical way to sequester carbon. It's a practical way to increase food production. Yes, you can actually increase the food production in this system. Now that takes about 20 years. But in 10 years, you can make a big difference on stream flow. So this is a viable thing for us to be doing, because those changes in the groundwater level will be reflected directly in changes in the stream flow. And streams are crucial to humanity, to our country, to our functioning as a as a society. Streams, all of our cities started on streams. There's a reason for that. And they're still on streams. What happens on streams is really a crucial thing. This regenerative process makes them less flashy. It makes the runoff lower, the base flow bigger, stabilizes everything. We have fewer floods and fewer droughts, which sounds like a confusing possibility. So this is a movement that really needs contributions from the field of science. There's so much that we can help them do, and we can shorten the length of time it takes them to get these kinds of processes to actually happen. In the monitoring system, and this slide got kind of cobbled, so don't worry about that. It isn't important to know what these things are. It's just that there's a lot of measurements that are being made, converted into more meaningful quantities here through models and equations to produce energy and water budget, few carbon things, stream flow characteristics, and ultimately the nutrient balances and carbon balances eventually, but that's in the future. Few parting thoughts. This regenerative agriculture is really about nurturing the biome, both in nature and in our own gut. The microbiome rules, okay? Like it or not, we depend on the microbiome for our existence. We don't exist without it. And we got to trap more sunlight. We're facing big disciplinary barriers, and one of the challenges we face is our own mind, because our own mind creates barriers through structure. Loves structure, all right? Structure is about control and hierarchy, four dimensions, X, Y, Z, and T, right? Wisiati. What we see is all there is, or what I see is all there is, right? That's the way we function as scientists, whether you believe it or not. This is the way you function, and the philosophers of science will demonstrate that to you 100 times over if you challenge them. So the structure of science, for example, is about the mind, knowledge and understanding. But when you try to connect things, you need context. And our disciplines have different incompatible contexts that are unstated, unseen, and sometimes even unknown. Right. So what's context? It's just background stuff we never talk about. But we need to know it to understand it. These disciplines are a barrier for us. Our mind takes care of context with assumptions. We might state them, we might not. Oftentimes we don't, but it takes care of them. Context is embodied in wisdom and assumptions, right? Wisdom is a matter of the heart or essence of what we are. It's very hard to talk about, it's hard to define. But this heart has seven dimensions, right? Unity, love, life, respect, honesty, justice, kindness. This is what life is about, and this is what we want to be motivated by. Thanks for your intentions.